This is Jonathan Bernstein conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Franklin Jones. We are in the we're in the Special Collections Library interview room, and the date is February 8th, 2002. And time is approximately 1:15. Now, Mr. Jones, I guess could you start off with a brief biographical sketch of yourself, where you were born, growing up, etc., up to your decision to enter the military?
Well, I was born in a smaller town outside of Lubbock named Lockney. Okay. It's a town of approximately 6,000 population, 5,000 to 6,000. And I grew up in a very small place between Floydada and Silverton, a place known as South Plains, a population of about 10.
Wow.
And after completing high school, I went to high school in Floydada. And after completing high school, the ratio of available men to women of marriage age in the county was not real good. There was 10 boys to every girl.
Wow.
And it seemed like the right thing to do was to go somewhere else. And Uncle Sam gave me the opportunity of joining the Army and seeing some of the other part of the world. And I started the Army off at Fort Hood, Texas, from there to Fort Sill, and Fort Sill then to Germany.
Okay. And what year was this?
In 61, I went to Germany. Joined the Army in 60, but in 61 went over to Germany.
Okay.
And spent a tour in Germany. Then got out of the Army, and it was out for about 10 months, then decided to go back in.
Hmm.
When I went back in, I went into the Army Security Agency.
Hmm.
And after going to school at Fort Devens for a couple of months, and I was released from the ASA, and sent back to Fort Sill. Fort Sill, I went through artillery training, so I got assigned to an artillery battalion at Fort Sill. Well, I had trained on 105 howitzers, which is small pieces of artillery. I had worked in the commons section with telephones, and I had worked some with repair parts in the motor pool. So when I got sent back to Fort Sill, they put me in the communication section again, in this artillery battalion, but instead of it being a tube artillery, it was a Persian missile, and which was a very large type battalion. And I was then put into the repair parts section for the automotive repair parts. And the unit gyroed to Germany. The whole unit went to Germany. So I spent another tour in Germany. And it was about a year and a half break in between tours in the States. And while in Germany, I was promoted up to the rank equivalent to a sergeant, which was Spec 5. And then I came back home and got married a girl from Hale Center, which is just north of Lubbock, and went back to Germany and spent the rest of my tour. From there, was sent to Fort Gordon, Georgia. And by the mix-ups of everything in Germany, they had mixed up considerably on my job titles and things like that. And until I got it straightened out, I was at Fort Gordon. From Fort Gordon, then they sent me to Fort Benning. And I've spent a couple of years at Fort Benning, working with the infantry school, the supply section. And from Fort Benning, I went to Fort Hollenberg. And Fort Hollenberg went to intelligence school. And from Fort Hollenberg, I was supposed to go directly to Vietnam. I got to Fort Lewis, Washington, and it was the first big troop cutback that they'd had in Vietnam. It was 125,000 troops they cut back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the easiest way to cut back troops is don't send more replacements over. So from Fort Lewis, I was turned around, shipped back to Fort Knox, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. I've been in Fort Knox for a couple of years, working with in the intelligence side with the G2 staffs at Fort Knox. And then I did get orders to go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. The guy in the Department of the Army, he didn't like the way that I wound up at Fort Knox. He didn't know it. It was not my fault, but nobody told him I went to Fort Knox and wasn't in Vietnam. One of the guys I worked with got orders to go to Vietnam. And he calls up the Department of the Army and he said, I'm not going to Vietnam until you get these other two guys that works in the office here that's never been to Vietnam over there first. That was the day my orders were cut to go to Vietnam. But the guy, he's got to make sure I had a real good tour, so he sent me to school for 6 months first. Sent to advisor school and language school. So I went to the advisor school, did that part of it, and then went to language school down at Fort Bliss and had the short language school, which was the 11-week language school. Okay. Then I went to Vietnam, and when I got to Vietnam, the guy that volunteered me to go, he had beat me there for 3 months.
Really?
So he still got there before I did, but we worked together. We had worked together at Fort Knox, and I stayed in Vietnam till 9 days after ceasefire. I got there in 72, stayed till 9 days after ceasefire in 73, and from there I was sent back to Fort Hood, and spent 6 years at Fort Hood, and went to Germany for another tour. From Germany, I came to Lubbock, retired from the military, came to Lubbock. I spent a little over 8 years in Germany, approximately a year in Vietnam, in various places around the United States.
Quite impressive. Now, stepping back to I guess your decision to go into the military, did you have any family members who had served, say, in World War II or anything like that?
The only family member I had to serve that I even knew was my uncle, that he'd served in World War II. Mm-hmm. And he had served under Patton in Africa. Mm-hmm. And when they landed on Sicily, the ship that he got off of dropped a short round, and he had shrapnel in his back. Mm-hmm. He was a disabled veteran. Mm-hmm. From World War II.
Did you talk to him at all about going into the military?
Very little. He didn't talk much about his military career. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was going to ask if you were drafted or did volunteer.
Volunteer.
Okay. Now, going through, I guess, basic at that point, still fairly early on, how was the training?
Well, our basic training at Fort Hood was quite different than most other places in the military at that time. Mm-hmm. We went to a tank battalion.
Really?
For basic training. Mm-hmm. There was one company that got basic training. There was one company that had mortar platoon training. And the rest of the battalion was straight tank battalion. Mm-hmm. T.O.N.E. tank battalion. Wow. So here we was, just an independent basic company in the tank battalion. There was a few battalions like that in Fort Hood. Mm-hmm. There was also one training battalion down there that just gave basic training. But ours was considerably different, to the fact that whenever we had extra duty on the weekends and things like that, they wanted us to do extra work, we went to the tank motor pool and we cleaned tanks. We didn't go on forced marches and things like that. We did what marches we had to do for the basic program. Mm-hmm. And one time when we went to the rifle range, we went out the close combat course, out charging a hill. Mm-hmm. when we went out there, well, the trucks got stuck because it's so wet out there. Mm-hmm. Well, our company commander was an aviator, so he got the helicopters come out and fly us all back to the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't walk back.
Wow.
It's quite different for the, as far as the basic goes, but we did do what we had to do for the requirements to complete basic training.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't go no extra mile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I hadn't heard of that before. So moving on to AIT, were you, I guess, what was your MOS at that point?
Well, I was a cannoneer. Okay. So after going through AIT, we took training on the towed howitzers, 105s, and it was a lot of work all going through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know one time I was so tired, and we went out to fire one night, that we was out in the field firing, and I laid back between the trails and went to sleep.
Really?
And firing, and I still went to sleep laying right behind the gun.
Wow.
Some of them on the 8 inches, they couldn't do that.
Imagine it's a little loud there.
But then for Fort Hood, for Fort Sill, I could go home on the weekends.
Hmm.
It wasn't that far to, went as far home as it is from Lubbock to Fort Sill.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, at that point, was there any talk of Vietnam, things going on?
Very little. Back in 60, 61, there was a little rumble, but it wasn't any headlines.
Mm.
That was down very low on the hush-hush lips.
Right.
Because the treaty which separated the North and the South only came in 55.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 years later, there wasn't many Americans committed there. There was some there,
right.
You knew where to look for them, but there wasn't many committed.
Okay. Were you aware of any advisor presence over there at that point? Or was
I don't even think I knew about anybody being in Vietnam in 60-61.
Okay.
There was other things that was more important after that.
Yeah, well, especially the Berlin crisis, et cetera.
After Fort Sill, I went to Germany.
Yeah.
And they built a wall in Berlin, mm-hmm. and we went up and sat for a week on the border,
mm-hmm.
with our 105 howitzers.
What was that like?
Well, we didn't even know why we was up there for 3 days. I mean, they called alert, they sent us out the field, and they put us up on the border, and that's where we went to a whole lot of times on our alerts, mm-hmm. anyhow. The only thing was, we got up there and never shot.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever we always went out there to train, we'd go up there and start shooting artillery.
Hmm.
We'd be up there 3 days and hadn't fired anything.
Hmm.
One of the guys had to go back in the post and get some water for our kitchen areas.
Hmm.
Got a newspaper and they're talking about a wall in Berlin.
Hmm.
We was about 4 miles from the East German border.
Hmm.
And then the same thing happened again whenever they had a little missile crisis down in Cuba.
Right.
And
where were you for that?
No, same place.
Still in Germany.
Still in Germany.
Huh.
That's whenever we had a whole lot of the draftees that was drawing for over three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were drafted for 2 years. There's a lot of them that spent more than three.
Hmm.
Whenever I first got to Germany, there was a tall guy that was there the night that all of the new people came in. He come around, you know, seeing who all was there and everything. They called him Tex. Well, the next day, the mailman came to me. He said, I had a letter. He said, oh, and by the way, the guy that we call Tex, he's from Floyd 82.
Hmm.
Well, I had never met him, but I went to school with both of his brothers. I knew both of them very well.
Wow.
Well, he got out of the Army. He was telling us he was short-timing when we got there and all. He got out of the Army. He came back to Florida to start his life over again. And then they had this little wall went up in Berlin. He had been put into a reserve unit, so they activated the unit, put him back in the Army. They built a wall in Berlin, and he was still in the army. And they just, I don't know how many years, he finally wound up spending on a 2-year draft. But it was more than 4.
Yeah, really interested sort of in the, I guess the sentiment during the, both the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, did you think you were going to war at that point? I mean, were you briefed on the situation?
Well, we were briefed to the point that our commanding officer told us that, he said, whenever you go, you're supposed to take 10 of them with you.
Really?
You're supposed to hold out for 72 hours so they can get replacements here. That was our initial briefing.
Well,
we were a detaining force. We wasn't there to win no battles. We was there to detain the enemy for 72 hours and to take 10 of them with us when we went. Because they had us outnumbered 10-1. Yeah, there was some concern there, but... what do you do when you're 18, 19 years old? You're not too concerned about everything. More concerned about the next good time you're going to have.
Mm. This is true. So, for the Cuban Missile Crisis, did you have the Pershings there? Were you with the Pershings?
No, I wasn't with the Pershings then.
Still 105s?
No, I was still with the 105s.
Okay.
When I was with the Pershings, they pulled 125,000 men out of Germany, and they stuck our battalion over there, and they figured we had as much firepower as 125,000 men.
Wow.
Pershing missile did not have a conventional warhead.
Right. Wow. Sort of staggering the amount of firepower.
Yes. But we had two birds on count all the time, two on standby, and one company was in maintenance.
Mm-hmm. So it was just, six missiles then total? Or how many missiles were in the
there battalion? There was six launchers in the battalion.
Okay.
And later years they went up to eight launchers.
Okay.
But two was on count,
mm-hmm.
on hold.
Ready to go.
They were on count.
They
were counted down to a certain part and inhaled.
Wow.
So they were basically on go.
Wow.
Not ready to go, but on go.
Wow. Huh. That's kind of staggering. Wow. All right. So I guess after the deployment to Germany in 63, where'd you head from there?
From Germany? Mm-hmm. Well, as I said, after that, I got out of the Army for about 18 months. I lived either in West Texas or Dallas.
Okay.
And then from Dallas, I went back into the military and went to Fort Davis, Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I was with the Army Security Agency.
Now, getting out of the Army, readjusting to civilian life at that point, any major readjustments? Or?
Well, yeah, because here I was, basically 21 years old, and by virtue of the experiences I'd had, the places I'd been, and things like that, the group that I grew up with was not at the stage of maturity that I was at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could associate a lot better with 24, 25-year-olds than I could 21-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's more the maturity level that I was at. So, yeah, it made a whole lot of difference.
Then, let's see, 18 months later, you were called back in?
Or I went back in
voluntarily.
You went
back in voluntarily. Yeah. Okay. Actually, I've never been to the Devons. I was in Air Force ROTC in college. Went to the Air Force's version I guess OSI was their intelligence agency, which is
the ASA is Boy, the area. Big plane with a frisbee on top of it.
Okay, AWACS.
AWACS.
Right.
Yeah, now we're getting into it.
Okay.
ASA is radio research.
Okay.
And because of where I had been and what I did in the first tour in Germany and the friendships I had, in ASA you had to have a top secret clearance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they started checking my clearance, they said, no.
Really?
Not maybe, but no.
Why's that?
So they wouldn't even give me a confidential clearance. They'd pull the top secret from me and wouldn't even let me have a confidential. Because of the friends that I had in Germany the first time over there. Some of the friends I had relations in Yugoslavia, East Germany, what used to be Prussia. So the military pulled my clearance. And it was until I was back in Germany the second time. As I said, I came back home on leave. I dated this girl from Hale Center. We got engaged. We dated for 2 weeks and got engaged. And I went back to Germany, and then they put me in for clearance again. In less than 30 days, it came back final. But when it came back, the guy that read me in for the clearance, he told me where my girlfriend lived, he told me where her dad lived, he told me about what time service record her dad had. And he knew more about me than I did at that time.
Wow.
Yeah, they had came back and they'd done a whole lot of checking, but the basic checks they didn't have to go back and redo because they did all that on my younger years. So all they had to do is the update part of it. Then they come back and they dumped the top secret on me with everything else that they could stick on it. The reason that they wanted me to have a top secret was because a lot of the things to do with that missile was top secret. And they needed someone to pull commander relief on guard duty. And it took a top secret clearance to pull commander relief on guard.
Wow.
Because the commander relief, he's one of them that carried the key to the bunkers where the warheads were at.
Wow. So that would be about 1965.
Right? That was around 65, 66.
Okay. Meanwhile, things seem to be heating up.
Things are starting to happen in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a lot of people that didn't want to be in that Pershing missile unit. The easiest way to get out of the unit was to volunteer to go to Vietnam. It had more than one benefit. You got out of the unit, and you get to go home on a 30-day leave. Don't matter if you had leave time coming or not, they would give you a 30-day leave in the States on the way to Vietnam. So several people have volunteered to do that. That was my thought. Whenever I re-enlisted in Germany, I got a very big reenlistment bonus, and I came home on my 30-day leave with the idea that as soon as I got back to Germany, I was going to volunteer to go to Vietnam, come back home for another 30 days, and I was going to party. But I got engaged while I was home, so that changed up the whole thing.
Yeah, I could definitely imagine. So,
So I had enough money to pay for plane tickets here and there, from here and back, buy a nice engagement ring and all that. It was worth it.
I'm dealing with that myself right now. So, yeah.
But looking back, it was worth it.
Okay. So, I guess, well, how long were you with the Pershing unit, though?
3 years.
3 years, okay. So, about 68.
Yeah.
Okay.
Things were really going pretty good in Vietnam then.
Definitely. Tet and everything. After, I guess, with that unit, what was the sentiment like in the country? I mean, were you here stateside at that point?
Well, and when I came back to the States, I came back to Georgia, and was in Fort Gordon for a short time. And down there, they, as I said, because of the mix-up on when I was promoted and all in Germany, I was promoted under one MOS, but I was drawing proficiency pay under another MOS.
Okay.
And they can't change, if you're drawing proficiency pay under an MOS, they can't just change it to another one.
Okay.
So they had to go back and get all this straightened back out, get me back under the MOS that I had proficiency pay in.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time that they were working with that, I was working in the personnel part in Fort Gordon, processing people to go to Vietnam.
Oh.
So I was in the overseas process. I was the overseas processor there for a while. And then from there, finally they got straightened out and they stuck me over to G2, which is the post security.
Okay.
And supply, well, I actually G4 in supply.
Oh.
And I was on the supply inspection team because I was drawing the proficiency pay in supply.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I went to Fort Benning and went to OCS for a while.
Really?
Both arches failed.
Hmm.
And so I had to get out of OCS. They stuck me in supply for the Small Arms Committee.
Mm-hmm.
So we were training either basic trainers or basic training, or mainly it was for the OCS course down there.
Okay.
For the Small Arms Committee.
What type of small arms were they using at that point? Were they still using M14s in training?
No, M16s. Well, we had the M16s, the M60 machine guns, 50 caliber machine guns, and we worked in conjunction with the mortars and those, but we had all the rifle ranges at Fort Benning. All the rifle and machine gun ranges, that's a lot of ranges.
Yeah. What was your opinion of the M16?
To me, it always worked good.
Right.
I was kept it looked good.
Mm.
Kept WD-40. As long as you kept spraying WD-40, it worked.
Huh. Okay.
Don't put no oil on it.
Mm-hmm.
They give you oil it down.
Mm-hmm.
No. Everybody used oil, they quit.
Really?
Everybody used WD-40, it kept working.
Huh. Oh. Fantastic.
M60 machine gun, it always worked good.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, well, we had 45s down there too, the pistols, 45, 38s.
Excellent.
BB guns. We had about three ranges of BB guns.
Oh. Were those used in training?
Yeah.
Really?
It's what they call quick kill.
Okay.
That they would throw something up in the air, and you shoot from the hip to shoot at it.
Right.
It's instinct shooting, what they call it.
Right.
And one of the guys I worked with down there, he could shoot an aspirin about 8 out of 10 times.
Wow.
With a BB gun, not aiming it, from the hip.
That's impressive.
That is instinct.
Definitely. Now, did you, knowing everything that was going on over there, processing people to go overseas to Vietnam, did you want to go? You said you volunteered previously.
I didn't volunteer. I was going to, but I didn't because I got engaged.
Right, okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood that.
While I was at Fort Benning, I got my little boy.
Really?
Yeah, that redheaded kid.
Hmm.
And so I had a wife and a kid. And they bought me a mobile home.
Hmm.
So, no, I wasn't. I wouldn't volunteer to go then. But I wouldn't fight it either. Because I knew that by military careers, if you didn't go, it wasn't too good.
Right. Gonna advance.
So. You didn't have a stamp on your records.
Hmm. Okay. Now, All right, going over to Vietnam, were you aware right away you were going to be an advisor?
From Fort Benning, I went to Fort Hollenberg.
Right.
To Intel School.
Oh, right. Okay.
Intel School, in the 8 weeks I was up there, basically, we stayed with Vietnam.
Okay.
Because Vietnam was going so good, being 68, 69.
Mm.
And so we studied Vietnam. Mm-hmm. As it was called intelligence school, and the part that we were studying, you know, is what an analyst would do.
Mm-hmm.
But we were studying it as Vietnam. Customs, background, history,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then whenever I left there, my whole outlook on Vietnam was different than anybody else's that I knew around, mm-hmm. other than the ones that went through the schools with us.
Right.
Because 9 out of 10 people didn't know why that Vietnam was even there. They
mm-hmm.
they had no understanding of why we was even involved in Vietnam.
What was your outlook?
Well, and just as a quick rundown, Vietnam started fighting for their independence in 1776 from the French. Okay, they fought the French up until the Second World War, of which the Japanese came in and took over Vietnam, took it over from the French. So the Japanese had Vietnam.
Hmm.
So the Viet Minh, that was fighting the French, the Viet Minh started fighting Japanese, and the war was over. Well, Japan lost the war, so we signed a peace treaty. All the allies signed on the peace treaty,
mm-hmm.
and we give Vietnam back to the French from Japanese. Well, that's left. The Viet Minh was still left out there. So, the Viet Minh was fighting the French again, and they fought them up to 1955.
Mm-hmm.
And the French did something that they always tell you don't do for military.
Mm-hmm.
The French went in the valley of Dien Bien Phu, and they blocked the valley. Blocked the entrance into Hanoi,
mm-hmm.
basically. They didn't take the high ground.
Mm-hmm.
Military history all the way back to Hannibal says take the high ground. So these little Vietnamese guys, they go get their artillery, they take it apart. One of them takes a handful of bolts, another takes a handful of nuts, another grabs a wheel, another half dozen of them grabs a barrel. They take their artillery up to the top of the hill. They put it back together. And then they start shelling the French. And by later years, even after I got to Lubbock, then I have made a friend with a guy that was flying in and out of the valley of Dien Bien Phu,
really?
Supporting the French.
Hmm.
Officially, the American Army was not in Vietnam in 1955.
Right.
He was flying in and out of the Valley of Dien Bien Phu, resupplying the French.
What was his name?
Bill Beatty. He doesn't live in Lubbock now, but then. But that's the French got whipped there,
mm-hmm.
so they had to go back to the peace table
mm-hmm.
with the Viet Minh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the French wasn't the only one that was in possession of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The Allies were. So it wasn't just the French that had to go back to the peace table.
Mm-hmm.
It was the whole Allies. The French, the English, the British,
mm.
all of them together. And the agreement that was come up with, the treaty, was Vietnam would be divided from north to south for 20 years. And at the end of 20 years, they would be allowed to establish their own form of government.
Mm.
you go back and start adding 1 and 1 and 3, run down the timelines on everything that's happened in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
When did we leave Vietnam?
We were out by 73.
No.
Well, 75.
75.
Right.
73, they pulled the last of the troops out. Right. That's when the ceasefire was.
Right.
And it had a 2-year sloppy time there.
Mm-hmm.
And then 75. And everybody said, well, why don't the Americans go back in there and stop them from coming into Saigon? We couldn't do it.
Mm.
We was on the peace treaty saying for 20 years, then they'd be allowed to establish their own form of government.
Mm.
It didn't say they had to be Democrats. It didn't say they could be communists. It didn't say they had to be, they could be a dictatorship. That's where they came down. That's
so, what about the, this was,
Now, that's,
I think it was 67? No, it was earlier than that, where they actually realized that if they had free elections, Ho Chi Minh, actually it was much earlier than 67, Ho Chi Minh would have been elected and basically would have ruined the chance of the South being a democratic government.
Well, they do. Depending on how much you want to look at the South being a democratic government or not.
Right, of course.
Jim wasn't too democratic.
Mm.
You get elected, and then you get ready to come up with another election, and you just abolish the House, and you say, well, I'm the only one.
Yeah,
how much democratic you want there?
Mm, true.
That's almost like happened down in Cuba.
Mm. Hmm.
And I think we learned a big lesson in Cuba is how come that we didn't go back in there and squelch Vietnam?
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, we're a democracy, and it's the best form of government that we could have.
Mm-hmm. May not be the
but
best
it
for
don't
else.
Mean that's the best for everybody.
All right. All right. Okay. Now, going over to Vietnam, you've been through Intel school, language school.
Then I went through the 6 months advisor school and language school that we studied Vietnam.
So you knew pretty much you were going to MACB at that point.
Oh, I was going to MACB. There was no question. I was an advisor.
Okay. Now, getting there, arriving in country, What was your first impression?
Hot. It was in last February, March, maybe March. It was hot.
Really?
It put into an old barracks type building.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have no windows in it. It had screens up, you know, mosquito screens and things mm-hmm. like that. But it was hot day and it was hot at night.
Mm-hmm.
And here we just left West Texas where
it was
pretty
hot.
Cold.
Oh, yeah.
January, February, it's pretty cold.
Yeah.
And I went to school down at Fort Bliss. Believe it or not, we even had snow at Bliss while I was down there.
Huh.
And it's just going from here where it's cold, and then all of a sudden, zap, you're over there where it's hot. Your nights and days are not straightened out.
Yeah.
And so the first thing they did was stick us in this place that right at MACB headquarters
mm-hmm.
for about 2 weeks till we kind of got acclimatized,
mm.
which was a big thing.
Mm.
But then every night we could hear the bombs dropping.
Mm.
I don't know how far they were from Saigon, but we could hear the bombs dropping.
Mm.
We knew we was there. But because I was with MACB, as soon as we got there, I was issued a rifle.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the big things that was in the news back then, that so many of them that went to Vietnam wasn't ever issued a rifle since they got there.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I went to the advisor team and was there basically 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Then I knew I was a bit.
So which advisor team was it?
It was Hamtan Province team. It was just south of, well, it's Bentui province.
Okay.
Bentui province. The town was Hampton. It was just south of Pantit, north of Bung Tao.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
it's right on the
third
coast.
Third core zone?
I don't even know what core.
Okay, yeah.
We was right on the coast.
Okay.
About a mile and a half from South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And of all the battles in Vietnam, I fought was there.
Hmm.
We fought the Battle of the Bulge. We had one old woman that was a cook, and she didn't know how to make less than a three-course meal.
Really?
And then we had an old man that was a cook that had been the head pastry chef of the French Embassy in Cambodia for 7 years before he came to Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
We had civilian cooks.
Eating well.
And fighting the Battle of the Bulge. So every afternoon we went out and played volleyball. Didn't matter if it was rain or shine. We had to work some of it off.
Mm. Sounds good.
And then every day, well, about twice a week, at least twice a week on average, me and somebody else would drive into Saigon, turning in equipment.
Mm.
Into Saigon or Tonsonut or train compound. That's where we had a lot of stuff we turned in.
Mm-hmm.
On a plantation.
Okay.
Long Bend.
Alright. Now, you arrived there in February, March. March, of course, was the beginning of the NBA Easter Offensive. How was that?
72?
Yeah.
I didn't notice anything in 72.
Really?
Nothing out of the ordinary.
Okay.
Because whenever I got there, the Americans were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And it appeared that the NBA and D.C. was wanting to leave the Americans alone.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to kill Americans because they didn't want the Americans to come back.
Right.
We were leaving and they was wanting us to go. And of course they would send in some mortars now and then, rockets. And after I got out to the team, you know, we got a couple of mortars came in. The second night I was there.
Right.
And that's when I got wounded.
Really?
And I refused a Purple Heart.
Hmm.
They told me whenever I got to the team, sitting at the end of the sidewalk, there's a trench. You go jump in the trench, go to the corner, there's a bunker in the corner, go to the corner. We get any incoming. The second night I was there, I had a couple of mortars come in. I'd never been down to that trench. They told me about it, but I didn't go look in it. So I run out, grab my steel pot, my pistol belt, my rifle, run down the end of the sidewalk, hop in the trench, and head to the corner. Well, about a foot off the bottom of the trench is a sewer pipe that went across that trench. Cast iron sewer pipe. And I caught it with both shins. And I went rolling in that bunker. Both shins bleeding.
Oof. God, I can imagine that.
That hurt.
Yeah.
But then every weekend, we go down and go swimming in the ocean.
Hmm.
Take the Jeep, all of us pile on the Jeep, go down the ocean, go out and go swimming. Hmm. Wade out about 100 yards. Stand, look down, count your toes, the water's so clear.
Uh-huh.
One day we went down, the water was just like glass. There wasn't a ripple on it.
Uh-huh.
Walked out in there, and turned and walked back to the shore. Counted 13 jellyfish within a foot of my leg on my back. And one day we went down to, one Sunday, went down to, there was a Portuguese man of war that washed up about 2 feet across, big old thing, up on the beach.
Yeah.
So you knew that's out there.
Hmm. Now, what was the sentiment in in the area where you were? I mean, were people sort of, I guess the civilian population and the military as well, were they sort of getting nervous that the Americans were pulling out?
No, not really. Not that team.
Hmm.
Because the team is actually winded down all the time that I was there.
Hmm.
Now, I got there, there was about 25 or 30 guys on the team.
Okay.
Whenever I left the team, there was about 4 military and maybe 4 to 6 civilians.
Hmm.
Was all that was left.
Okay.
They did have somebody leave, they didn't replace them. And it was just as wind down all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the civilians around there didn't like us to go because we pumped a lot of money into their economy.
Right.
We had all civilian guards, we had civilian cooks, we used a lot of daily hire people. And, you know, everybody that you employ, that puts money into town.
Okay.
And so, now, probably I knew this better than anybody else on the team, as far as the military went. Because I was the only military on the team that spoke Vietnamese.
Hmm.
Now, there was all the civilians that was on the team, they spoke Vietnamese.
Hmm.
And our senior advisor was a civilian.
Okay.
So we worked, well, I suppose the civilian side was really under the CIA.
Hmm.
And then the military side, you know, was under the military, but yeah, we were working for them.
Okay.
And our aviation support that we had, the fixed wing would come in and out every day. They were Air America.
Okay.
The CIA had bought Air America from Lady Bird.
Right.
Then 2 days a week we had Air America choppers who come out and work for the team.
Right.
2 days we had military choppers. So we had kind of back and forth.
Wow.
All right. So our team had to cover the whole province.
Yeah, what exactly were the team's responsibilities?
Well, we was to advise the province headquarters.
Okay.
And our police advisor was a civilian. He was a retired New York policeman.
Hmm.
And he worked with the police.
Hmm.
Well, for my part of it, because I had the supply background and I had the intelligence backgrounds, the intelligence MOS, the supply, and all that, okay, I had a counterpart in the police.
Mm-hmm.
I had a counterpart in the sector S2,
mm-hmm.
which is security. I had a counterpart in the G4, or the sector 4, which was the sector supply. I had a counterpart in the sector supply and maintenance company. So I had 4 counterparts, plus I did the supply function for the team.
Mm-hmm.
And me and another guy, a master sergeant, we made water.
Mm-hmm.
We had our 500 gallon blivet to sit on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And the town only turned on the water certain times in the day. So we had a commode bowl float on this, and this 500 gallon blivet.
Mm-hmm.
When they turned on the water, well, it would fill up.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever it filled up, when we had another one up on top of the water tower.
Mm-hmm.
When the one up on top would get low, we would go down there and treat the one in the bottom, the chlorine, mm-hmm. the catalyst, and then pump it through a filter that came off the ship, pump it up to the top barrel.
Hmm. Okay.
And so we purified our own water that way.
Hmm.
And every month we took a test of it into Saigon, had them check it at the hospital.
Hmm.
And they said we had the purest water in Vietnam.
Wow.
That's even what we put through the commodes.
Hmm.
And yeah, we had indoor restrooms and everything.
Hmm.
Well, whenever I got there, we had one compound that was pretty good size. And it had, maybe 20 buildings on it. We got down to so many people, we didn't even have a person per building, so we turned that one over to the Vietnamese. And we moved across the street, the CBs left, they were there.
Mm.
When the CBs left, we took over the CB compound.
Mm.
And so it was one building. Very nice made buildings. CB's made the building.
Hmm.
They did a real good job of making buildings.
Absolutely.
It was kind of mortar proof.
Hmm.
They gone in top of it and put a ceiling in it.
Hmm.
And ceiling was made out of PSP pads.
Okay.
And had 18 inches of sandbags on top of that.
Wow.
And it had a metal roof on the top of it, on top of the building. So if we'd got a mortar, the metal roof would set the mortar off,
right.
And it wouldn't have came through 18 inches of sandbags.
Definitely. Wow.
And then we had two real nice air conditioners in the building. We had our own 20 kW generator, and power compound.
So, did you go out on any combat operations with Vietnamese units, or was it
we didn't go out on the operation.
Okay.
Now we had one guy that did, and he was a major. He did for a while.
Mm-hmm.
He had his Army career was kind of at a standstill. He was a major that he had been captured.
Hmm.
In Bay of Pigs.
Really?
He was a porter of Cuban.
Mm-hmm.
And he was involved in the Bay of Pigs.
Wow.
And the Army gave Cuba a bunch of tractors to get him back.
Hmm.
Well, after he'd been POW down there, because of that Bay of Pigs turned out, he went out on a few exercises with him. When they did out on ground searches and things.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I got all the reports come in on what supposedly was captured and brought back, things like that. And the best I could tell, between the Americans and the French, we talked the Vietnamese real good. Because whenever they pick up 80 tons of rice one day, by the time it gets turned into Saigon, it's something like 5,000 pounds of rice. Saigon's real happy they got 5,000 pounds of rice.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody on the way down the pecking chain got their tonnage of rice. We talk real good.
Sounds up. Now, I guess... at that point, 1972, there were 70,000 U.S. servicemen in country, roughly. Most of them were getting ready to leave. Of course, Nixon's talking about peace with honor. Does that hold water?
Yeah, that's whenever they sent me back to Saigon from the team. Like I said, the guy in DA was not real happy with me. So they weren't going to send me back. They put me there in Saigon, working the Combined Intelligence Center. Yeah, I had a lot of good Vietnamese friends in there. But I learned one thing real quick. I thought I knew how to play ping pong. But you don't play ping pong being simple as suckers. And out on the team, I learned something else. You don't play volleyball with them either.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And whatever guy's 4'9", he can jump up with the middle of his waist up over the top of the net.
That's impressive.
Boy, they slam ping pong balls like you never thought of. They slam volleyball the same way.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite a experience working there. I was working on one side of the desk, and right across from me, the Vietnamese on the other side. A lot of times we'd get in reports that we'd look at, pass them over to our next guy, but they didn't go across the desk.
Really?
We couldn't share them with them.
Why was that?
They didn't look good.
Was there any concern of North Vietnamese or Viet Cong infiltrators?
What, in
people?
Yeah. They were probably there, but we weren't that concerned with them.
Right.
I was in Saigon when they blew up the ammo dump.
Hmm.
It's 14 miles away from where I live, but I think first rack ammo was something like 78 tons.
Wow.
Napalm went up. It made a pretty good boom. I slept good. The next one they got me awake for.
Really?
I was outside whenever it went off. Just like twilight. You didn't need no light for nothing. That thing went off the whole Saigon. I think the only buildings that damaged was Americans' buildings. The other ones had glass in the windows. Except Sigby. Sigby didn't have no windows in our building. It's a flat top building.
Okay.
No windows.
Concussion just go right through.
Concussion went, knocked every light bulb out of every light fixture through the whole building then. Fluorescent lights.
Huh.
I don't know how much that roof jumped whenever that thing went on. The concussion hit it. That whole building had to dance.
Definitely.
It didn't work, man. The glass everywhere.
Yeah.
Huh. All the loud chased down.
God. Not having experienced anything like that, it's just mind-boggling to
try to fathom it. It busted windows in MACB headquarters. Mm. That's 14 miles from Appledump.
Wow.
So you think the concussion?
Yeah. Huh.
It did knock down a bit to me's hooch. I mean. You take a grass top house, no windows in it. What happens when the concussion gets you?
Just very wrong.
The lizard falls out the roof, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And everybody had a lizard.
Yeah. Really?
I had two lizards in my room.
Really? Cool. What kind of lizards?
Really? Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, they had a different name, but I'm not going to say
that. Yes, I've heard of them.
They crawl around the walls, you know. Oh. They'd eat their way from mosquitoes.
Mm.
I mean, you liked your lizard because they eat the mosquitoes.
Mm.
He had mosquitoes everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you encounter any other types of wildlife there?
What?
Any other types of wildlife? Monkeys, tigers?
I didn't personally, but while I was there, there's one day one of the guys went to the ammo bunker. He was going to get some plastic explosive out of it. He was going to destroy some ammunition.
Mm.
He opened it up, and there was a sand cobra in there.
Mm.
And he let it have some room. On our little compound there where the sea bees had been, it had Constantina wire around it and everything. About once a year, we go out and spray it down with gasoline, diesel, JP4, whatever that was left in drums and all,
right.
Burn off the weeds. It was in the barbed wire. One time we burned them, there was three banana vipers that was dead there.
Wow.
Banana viper, not quite as deadly as a bamboo viper.
Mm-hmm.
And one day we had one of the couple of guys that went up to one of the districts, got to pick up a piece of equipment, bring it back. They was going down the road in their Jeep. They ran up on a cobra. He was coiled out in the middle of the road, looking at him right straight through the windshield. So you can figure he was coiled at about 4 feet in the air at least.
Snake.
That was a king cobra.
Yeah.
They had picked up a baby elephant up there the year before I got there, brought it back in the chopper. The chopper pilot was not very happy because the little baby elephant got excited in the chopper and he messed all over that sucker. That was Air America chopper though. They were paid good for it.
Oh.
That's good. Other than the ones that we eat, you know, our police advisor would go out and buy our seafood.
Mm-hmm.
He'd go out with the checkpoint. The police would go out in the morning to meet the fishing boats coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Buy the red snapper, lobster, shrimp. It's the freshest shrimp to still be alive.
Wow.
It didn't matter whether it was popcorn shrimp or it was prawns, it was $1 a kilo.
Wow.
Prawns, you couldn't put but four of them on the plate.
Mm.
They could have covered the plate completely. Mm. Oh, they're good.
Wow. Do you eat a lot of the local food?
Well, that's what we got in local food. And, well, a whole lot of the stuff that went through our kitchen came out of local because we'd drive in Saigon and buy all of our food.
Mm.
We bought some. We want prime ribs. They usually come out of the commissary or something like that. But the big part of what we got came local. The we was off the beaten path. Mm-hmm. QL1 was the main highway. It goes from Saigon to Hanoi, actually. And we was about 7 or 8 miles off of that.
Okay.
But to the ocean side.
Mm-hmm.
But the peddlers that was coming down from Dalat going into Saigon to sell our goods,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them would detour off of the road and come over and sell something to us, make mm-hmm. enough money to get back into Saigon. And so we, tomatoes, strawberries, celery, anything mm-hmm. like that, we bought from those peddlers.
Okay.
A lot of the, like the celery stalks, we got the bottom of the stalk be 4 inches across, and the whole stalk be just as tender as it can be. Oh, it was good. And the strawberries be almost about half the size of your fist. And big, real good.
Big strawberry.
And in the daytime, a whole lot of times we'd take off during the day, go get in the Jeep, go downtown, go shop wherever we wanted to in town, go to jewelry shops. Our military chopper crew that came out to us, they got to where they was fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Who got to come to our team
hmm.
because they had to go to different teams all over Vietnam.
Hmm.
But it was a fight to who got to come to our team
uh-huh.
because they all knew that the Mama Sons wanted to cook breakfast
hmm.
and they could come flying to our team and we would give them enough time to go eat something and they'd come in, they could order eggs or whatever they wanted, anything they wanted for breakfast, pork chops and gravy or whatever. And they loved the team. And then if we got through early in the day, they'd take one of our Jeeps, go downtown, go shopping. Well, we had something happen, and I don't know just exactly how it all happened.
Mm-hmm.
But we wound up there before I left with every man on the team. Every military guy on the team had a crew serving weapons.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Either you had a machine gun or you had an M79 grenade launcher.
Hmm.
Everybody had one. Some of us had two. And yes, I had a case of CS grenades. And I had a case of double lock buck for M79.
Really?
And
beehive rounds?
No, the double lock buck.
Really?
Just an actual double lock buck.
Hmm.
And I shot him one day, instead of a 55-gallon barrel up, I held the thing waist high and shot at it. First one hit the ground about 20 feet in front of me, and then it just strung me out. I don't know how many double lock bucks in a 40-millimeter round.
Do you know if it was the steel shot or lead shot?
I think it was lead. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, because earlier on in the war, there was some controversy. The North Vietnamese complaining about the beehive double lock buck round. Guys eventually dying of lead poisoning. And so they later on switched it over to steel shot, and then they got rid of it because the steel wasn't working. So I was just wondering if you were still using the lead shot rounds.
Whatever you weren't supposed to have, that's what I had.
Sounds good.
Everybody on the team had a vehicle,
okay.
except for me.
Huh.
I had two.
What kind of vehicle?
I had a Jeep and a 2.5 ton.
Huh.
Well, the 2.5 ton actually belonged to the district. It mm. belonged to the Vietnamese, but it was mine.
Hmm.
The Jeep I had, nobody ever figured out where it came from. It just happened to wind up there.
Really? The
first cab had been in that area for a while.
Mm.
And I think first cab had lost a lot of vehicles to combat losses that we wound up with.
Hmm.
That way before my time, but
interesting. So, sort of sounds like my grandfather was in the 83rd Division in World War II, and by the end of the war, they were calling it the 83rd Mechanized Division because they had borrowed, stolen, or just acquired a vehicle for just about every unit in the division.
So, no, I said every yeah. man.
Yeah. Oh well, yeah, exactly.
So, and whenever I left the team, though, we had no property.
Hmm. Really?
On the books.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any vehicles. We didn't have any weapons.
Hmm.
The only thing we had was our classified comm gear. Because you don't borrow somebody's crypto set.
Right.
And that's the only thing we had. And every man had a almost like a hospital bed, one of these real very nice beds. And everybody had weapons.
Yeah, how did you come to acquire all these crew served weapons?
That's what I said. That all happened before I got there. I know the 1st Cav had operated there for a while. I think maybe the 82nd had operated there for a while. Because our runway for our airport, the actual airport we had, it was a very improved runway. Petaprime. And there was a terminal building even.
Really?
No windows in it or anything. It wasn't a very big building, but there was an actual terminal building there. And the taxi strip coming off the runway to the building was about 30 yards.
And this was right by your own building?
Up on the hill, just okay. Compound there. You know, how things happened during wartime, who knows?
Yeah.
Like Sealand Trucking Company. Man, they had a semi truck going over there all the time. Every ship went over there had a bunch of them.
Really?
Even I came back. What happened to them? And like on the team, you know, I said everything we had wasn't accounted for. It was just above and beyond. But whenever I left, I don't know what happened to it. Now, I went into Saigon. I worked at Sigby there. That was under Usabee. That wasn't under Magby. And I spent a few months there, and then they sent me up to Da Nang. At first they sent me to Pleiku. They didn't have a job for me. So then they sent me to Da Nang. And 40th Combo Detachment. That's who I was with at Da Nang. I thought I was lost whenever I got there. Because they told me that Saigon was going to send you to this MI detachment, Da Nang. Got Da Nang at the airport. Stepped off the plane. I said, who are you looking for? Sergeant, MI detachment. He said, they're not here. I'm 40th Combo Detachment. That's what you're going to be called all the time you're Da Nang.
How long were you there?
I wasn't there, but 2 or 3 months. It wasn't long. But it was, it was a bad assignment.
Really?
I was supply. That was, actually, the first sergeant and the company clerk was the only two people in that whole detachment that didn't have an MI-MOS. But I had MI-MOS, but I was there as their supply. Well, the supply sergeant and the supply officer that had been there before I got there had just got through with their general court-martial for misappropriating a battalion. And I had to go in there and pick up. That's why I said it's a bad assignment.
Yeah.
You look in the property books, you could tell what this is supposed to be there. It had been an MI battalion, and they stood it all the way down to a detachment, which was a whole lot smaller than a company. They had turned in no equipment.
Well, obviously with them getting a court-martialed, they didn't get away with it, but how did
they
do that?
They got a court-martial that they did get away with.
Really?
It seems that after talking and finding out, probably, they had a real good friend in the Air Force. Loadmaster, probably on C-141. and he would deliver equipment anywhere in Southeast Asia that you wanted to pay for. However he got work that way, I don't know, but evidently it worked in there some way that way. And he was delivering trucks, equipment, everything. By the time we got ceasefire notification, couldn't tell you what was supposed to be there. Nobody could. Parts that had been ordered on, you couldn't tell what came in, what hadn't, anything. You couldn't make heads or tails out of the books. And the day they came in with the ceasefire, the day it went into effect, we was in a little building out behind this bigger building. Bigger building, maybe a 40 by 60.
Okay.
But we was in a little smaller building out behind it with the rat rig next to it. That morning, here comes the NVA and the VC start moving in the bigger building.
With you still there?
With us still there.
Wow.
Here where the four powers agreement is in the building right next door to us. And here we just pull the night before all of our agents in off of these little teams around the countryside. That their primary mission had been to neutralize the enemy. What was our life worth? And we've been on the same building with the NVA and the VC. So they got us out of there that day. They sent down planes from Saigon to pick us up. And I know I went out to the airport and I had my duffel bag on my shoulder. But I've been turning this stuff. I had to get turned in over on Monkey Mountain, Deepwater Pier. And I didn't have time to ship anything. Well, we had about 3 days notice, you know, when the ceasefire was going to be.
Right.
I didn't have time to ship nothing. And I get out the airport, my duffel bag on my shoulder, walk up the airplane, it had this little beast craft, pilot there at the bottom. He said, Jones? I said, yeah. He said, you can't take a duffel bag on. I said, you better check your manifest again. He looks at his manifest, he says, Jones, bag and baggage. He turned around, this Lieutenant Colonel standing beside him and said, sorry, Lieutenant Colonel, you've done been bumped by a duffel bag. And the Colonel was very happy.
Wow.
It was our plane. It was in my plane. We had our chopper up there, Da Nang, too. That I got there the day after we bombed Da Nang. I don't know how many planes it was. It was Air Force, Marines, Navy. They got word that there was an NVA tank battalion refueling in the open. And they went on a joint mission. Some kid back in Saigon dropped a map designator. Like instead of AB, he put AA on the map designator. Which brought it down exactly 100 kilometers south, north end of the runway, Da Nang Airport.
Oh, God.
There's one American killed and then. But one of those 500 pounders got a direct hit on the 40 foot JP-4 tank. It was still burning when I got there.
Wow.
There was holes inside the village that you just about walked through. Shrapnel holes.
Wow.
They did not down any Vietnamese hoochies across the fence either.
Yeah, they're durable.
Well, my tour in Vietnam was quite different than most of the guys that was out in the bush and all that. And yes, part of mine was in the bush, but it wasn't walking out on patrols.
Right.
It was like when I was up first on the team, I only had three interpreter translators assigned to me. Three of them. I didn't talk to near that many people.
Now, were you advising the province, or were you, I guess, advising the province chief as far as military operations, or day to day?
Military operations.
Okay.
Which really I did most of the advising to either my counterparts or to the senior advisor.
Okay. I guess they were Argon units? Or police?
RS and PFs.
Oh, okay.
Rough Puffs.
Right.
RS is the regional force.
And popular force.
Okay. The PFs is your little village team.
Okay.
And one of our little house boys that we had there, he got drafted into the PF right after I got there.
Really?
When he turned, I think, 13 or 14. But most of them was just crippled and crazy. You know, that's the home guard.
Yeah.
While I was in Saigon, there at the Combined Intelligence Center, there's one time that we got a report of an NVA regiment that came into the Delta. I had the Delta region. An NVA regiment, 25,000. Came into the Delta. 25,000. They went to Seven Sisters Mountain. And we pounded them for 2 weeks. B-52s. Then at the end of 2 weeks, we quit pounding. And all 25,000 of them walked out of the mountains. And they started out across the Delta.
Wow.
And every time they'd hit one of these little hamlets, PF flare up. And so they'd take off a different direction. Hit another hamlet, the PF flare up. After 2 weeks of them running around in the Delta, well, the B-52s caught them a couple of times out in the open. But after 2 weeks of them trying to run around and trying to get into a town, all 10 of them started back to Cambodia.
Wow.
One of them, Chu Hoy, came over to our side. Because he said he wasn't going back to take the consequence. 25,000 to 10.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, the reason? They were guarding their house. They were guarding their mom. They were guarding their wife.
Okay.
They had everything in the world that they were fighting for. And they were going to fight for everything they had, and they did.
That's impressive.
Now, as far as working with the regional force where we was at, quite often they was at with the airfield when everybody's out there. See a sparrow fly over. And we're taking M16, and he picked the eyes of the sparrow. Blow his head off. They love to eat sparrows.
Really?
But gets into a firefight, he's not going to look what he's shooting at. He's just going to make a noise. Like a show.
Why is that?
He's going to keep his head down. He won't get shot.
Yeah.
But if he comes to something he wants to eat, sucker's a good shot. Every one of them.
Wow. Interesting. I guess that sort of makes sense.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, a whole lot of it you got to use common sense with. Customs of Vietnam. They got customs over there that you never even dreamed of here.
Really? Yeah. Like what?
You don't go up to a little boy, right? Here, you go up to a little boy and go and pat him on the head, right? Not there.
Really?
His good luck genie's on top of his head. You pat him on top of his head, that genie jumped down off his head. So if you catch yourself patting him on top of the head, you reach down real quick, grab the shoulders, both shoulders, where a genie will jump back up on top of his head.
Okay.
If you don't do that, man, you done alienated. You sure don't go take the peanuts out of this little thing over on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. Looks like a shrine. Mm-hmm. You don't go get the peanuts and eat them. No, you just eat God's food.
Hmm. Alright.
You know, that some of the stuff that we learned in the schools have very little meaning until that you really get to dealing with the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before you're going to find out that you, about the peanuts and about the little bowls of rice.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I first got to the team, I'd heard so many stories that, oh man, I didn't know. And the first week I was there, we got invited to the village chiefs for a big meal spread, all the advisors.
Mm-hmm.
And he had kind of like boxed lunches where it'd been catered in.
Mm-hmm.
It had spring rolls and all that. Oh man, it was food fit for a king.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd heard so many cats and dogs that I wasn't going to eat half of that. Well, after being there a while, I found out a whole lot about that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. There's some stuff you can't eat, some stuff you better leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
There's one place that, whenever we drive back into Saigon, there's a little narrow place in the road where there'd been a fire base. And we stopped this little restaurant on the side of the road, going and get some coke.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure to tell them, don't bring any ice. Drink the coke out of the bottle. Anything that had their name on it, like you see in America,
mm-hmm.
it was good to drink.
Right.
There's Coke, Dr. Pepper, or whatever they had. If it, there's the same thing that that you'd find here in the States. It's bottled under the same standards.
Mm-hmm.
But there ain't no time where they got the water to make that ice.
Mm-hmm.
And you just float them at half a time, just real quick.
Hmm.
The water puddle out behind the building. They can get the water from where they can get the water.
Right.
And the big thing that whenever we get in 55-gallon drums of JP4 to refuel the choppers, whenever the work choppers come out,
mm-hmm.
get a barrel gets empty. Well, we a lot of times give it to some Vietnamese that work around there. They go cut the top out of it. Put over the side of their house to catch water in.
Mm.
They'd use a barrel or two of water a week.
Mm. Still drinking jet fuel.
Yeah. But, you know, that's what they had to wash in and all that.
Yeah.
I mean, they can wash for 3 days on a gallon.
Mm. Wow.
The last Bob Hope show that they had over there, I was standing there in Saigon watching it. I was probably the only soldier other than the MPs that had a rifle on his shoulder watching the Bob Hope show.
Really? What was that?
I had guard duty after the show was over.
Hmm.
And that's whenever I was signed to SICV.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got signed to Saigon there to SICV. Well, they issued me a rifle. Well, I'd never been issued a rifle whenever I came into the country. So I had one in my wall locker and I had one in the arms room.
Hmm.
So whenever I got guard duty, it was like that. I didn't go and draw a rifle out of the arms room, the hassle of that. I just had my own rifle.
Hmm.
That morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, it's 90 degrees, 90% humidity. That's Christmas Eve.
Right. Well, we've been going for a little over an hour, so okay. Go ahead.
One other real good superstition in Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
is if you have hair on your face, it denotes wisdom.
Hmm.
And when I was in Vietnam, I grew a mustache,
mm-hmm.
a handlebar mustache. And it would just about touch my ears on both sides if I pulled it out all the way. But right. I had it curled.
Uh-huh.
And if I'd start talking to someone and kind of wondered about how honest they would be with me, I'd reach up and start playing with the mustache.
Hmm.
And every time I did, their head would drop and their eyes wouldn't look at me.
Hmm.
And I could tell they weren't lying to me.
Hmm.
Because they thought I was so smart, I could read the mind anyhow. And so to have a handlebar mustache in Vietnam was very much of a one step up just to have it.
A lot of the cow guys must have gotten away with more than they realized then.
Well, like I said, I had one, so I knew that even if I was talking to a woman, boy, she sure wouldn't look at me.
Really?
No, because they have very much of a sense of women being inferior to a man.
Mm-hmm.
Which some of them I had to deal with, it was quite the otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
The first place I was at, I had one woman that was an interpreter translator. Actually, she was more just an interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And she could type and everything. I mean, she could lots faster on it than the men were that was there.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I went into Saigon, there was one girl in there that she had a degree in English.
Mm-hmm.
And she was extremely smart. She was, and of course, a lot of the guys, they were smart. I don't know, I would have to put her above just the majority of the men that was there. There was a couple of real good losers over there too.
Right.
Yeah, one Vietnamese guy had Harley 45. Where's he going to get a part for it? Police interceptor, Harley 45. It had to be during the 50-year bike. There was another one that had an Edsel car
Winding
up down the road. Another one that had a 49 Ford.
Huh.
Of those three, I mean, either they had to make a part or.
Because
there wasn't no place they could buy a part for them.
Imagine.
And there was extremely a lot of people in Vietnam that spoke English.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the majority of the educated either spoke English or French. French had been there so long, there's a lot that spoke French.
Mm.
But for any technical field, you either have to speak French, English, Russian, or German. They don't write textbooks in other languages.
Right.
So if you're going to go in a technical field, you're just about pinned down on one of them.
Now, as an advisor, I guess when you were advising the province chief and his people, was there a sense of them just taking your advice or for what it was worth, or were they basically just going to go about their own thing anyway?
Well, they would take it.
Mm-hmm.
And they would weigh it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I really give much advice to them that, well, I would advise some, but I wouldn't tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a difference in advising and,
or,
you're right, and trying to tell somebody how to run their life. I would never run their life.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, starting out, you know, it weren't my battle. The battle is what was going to be the outcome, final outcome of their system of life. Were they going to be Democrats? And they've already, back in the early 60s, decided they weren't going to be Democrats. The province I was in was the summer home for President Zim.
Mm-hmm.
That was his, he made the province out of two other provinces for his summer home.
Really?
The province chief's house or headquarters was the old president's
summer palace.
Yeah. And in front of that summer palace is a road. It's about a half mile long, actually a divided highway. It was divided by about 100 yards. One side went one way, the other side went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And out through the middle of it was arbors of ornamental plants.
Mm-hmm.
There were big flower pots out there of different ornamentals.
Wow.
There was a lot of the ornamental rubber plants that was planted out there. And it's a lot of palm trees, coconut trees,
mm-hmm.
banana trees, and everything that was planted down there for the looks.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it had been dragged out pretty bad because once president's ousted, and he was ousted in the way he was, that they didn't keep it up.
Right.
But you could tell what had been there.
Hmm.
And it was a show place. It's supposedly one of the lakes that's up in the province, and one of the best fishing places that there was. And it supposedly had tigers around it.
Hmm.
I wasn't going to go up and look for no tigers. Because
yeah.
I was pretty sure that that province also had a landed spot where that the NBA and the BC brought supplies into the south.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Saigon there, where I worked, we got the daily arc light strike reports, mm-hmm. pictures and everything. We had one little kid there one day that he's brand new in country, he's a little spec 4. They put him in the arc light section. And they come up one day, they had our flight of B-52s scheduled to come to Vietnam, but they didn't have any targets for him.
Mm.
They had to figure out some target for him. They told the kids, go up there, find us a target on the map. He walks over to the map, looks at the map, he said, how about right there? I said, that looks good, it's a free fire. He picked a free fire place.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that looks good. So they went over it and dropped a flight of B-52 bombs on it. And something like 25 secondary explosions.
Hmm.
It was in a place that had not had anything.
Wow.
So they went back over it for 3 days straight, and they got secondaries all the time.
Wow.
And then they found out it was in the Parrot's Beak.
Mm-hmm.
The NBA was moving their headquarters in there. And of the rules of the ceasefire, everybody got to keep what property they owned mm-hmm. when the ceasefire went into effect. And the NBA had to get their headquarters into South Vietnam before the ceasefire went into effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they were moving into Parrot's Beak.
Wow.
And this kid just got lucky.
Hmm. Wow.
Done some of the most damage he could done.
Hmm.
Especially for the time, you know.
Wow. Man. That's real. It's impressive.
He didn't even know the country. He just seen there's some free fireplaces and
mm-hmm.
where they can dump a load. They wasn't going to carry them home.
Mm. So did you yourself do any directing of arc light strikes?
I worked on a lot of reports that went to the president's desk. Mm.
President Chu?
No.
President Nixon?
Yeah.
Okay.
New president.
Okay.
We had reports on what was friendly, what was foes, and what's neutralized and what's not.
Okay.
And daily, I worked on a lot of those reports.
Okay. Now, with the, I guess you said you got 3 days notice of the ceasefire being put into effect. Other than just rush to get things prepared, get your own stuff out. What was the sentiment? Were people happy it was over?
I think generally everybody was happy that it was over. Because, as I said before, even the people that I worked with,
mm-hmm.
very few of them even understood why we were there, who mm-hmm. put us there.
Right.
Everybody said, well, it was Kennedy got us involved.
Mm-hmm.
No, it wasn't Kennedy. Was Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever he signed the peace treaty
mm-hmm.
at the end of the war, that's yeah. when we became involved.
Yeah.
Now, the involvement changed. It didn't improve. It changed after that, you get one president ousted, another one get in, and then he does away with the parliament, and it basically becomes a dictator. But they don't know the history. They don't know how long they've been fighting for it. So, sentiment, yeah, they was glad it was over. Because how many people in the United States, is, you know, they're thrilled. K-Triple-L the other morning, I was listening to two disc jockeys early in the morning, was bragging about that they were against the war. They did their dissident stuff here in the States. They didn't go to the war. They were very proud of it. But that night before that, I was invited down to the Golden Corral. They invited all the veterans down there for the supper. So the whole place was packed with veterans. All the way from World War II up. World War I, World War II, you knew exactly why you were there. You knew exactly the incident that got you involved. And you knew exactly when the peace treaty was signed and it was over. And Vietnam wasn't that way. When we left, who won? Nobody.
Was there a sense of anything being accomplished?
You could tell that anything had been accomplished. But it had. Yes, they were allowed to form their own government. And it wasn't the one that the South had had. But that's not what the treaty said.
Now, with that in mind, I mean, was there, I guess, early on, the whole thing was containment of communism. By the time you were there, was there any talk of that at all? I mean, was there any sort of falling back on that as a reason for being there?
Well, yeah. We was trying to, most people think, well, we was trying to keep the communists out of South Vietnam. Well, we were. But, to a point. Because, no, we couldn't control the country. We wasn't there to control the country. In fact, we did control the country probably more than we should at the times. Because our presidents did control it a whole lot. And, what was it, 1968, when there were about 500,000 people, 500,000 Americans in Vietnam? And Saigon was one of the largest ranking American cities by the amount of Americans that lived there. Thompson Newt Airport was about the third busiest airport in the world. Reese was the first. In 68.
Really? I didn't know that.
But see, Reese, they had flights taking off out there in formation. You take off five planes at a time and you make five touch and goes, that's take off and landing.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
In formation. O'Hara was second.
Wow. That's a lot of takeoffs and landings.
There had a lot of pilots that came off of there. Just about everyone in the Air Force. Up to a point.
I'm curious.
Now, there was a lot of sentiment. Then there was a lot that didn't want to leave. Now, we had a little guy a few years ago, Garwood or something like that was his name. He turns up. He was MIA. He we've got a lot of MIAs. And just because they're MIAs don't mean they're dead.
Right.
Now, the last time I was over in Germany, I went down and visited with some of the people that was at the unit that I was at the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that there was one guy that had just been down there to visit with a bunch of his friends that he'd been with in Vietnam. And he was listed as a MIA. And he was traveling in Germany under a Swedish passport.
Hmm.
The military could do nothing with him in Germany.
Hmm.
He had broke no laws in Germany. He deserted in Vietnam, but he had broke no laws in Germany.
Hmm.
So the military couldn't do nothing with him. They could deny him entrance to that compound in Germany, but they couldn't arrest him.
Wow.
Germany wouldn't arrest him.
Hmm.
And he was a deserter. He deserted in Vietnam. And we got in 68, 500,000 was that, it's half a million.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many that there was through the whole course of Vietnam. Probably 2.5 million at least.
About that, too.
And for a war that was as unpopular as Vietnam was, if you get 0.01% that's a deserter, that's not very much, is it?
No.
How many is that out of 2.5 million?
Well, it's a number.
It's a number.
Yeah.
How many we got that we can't account for?
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Don't mean they're all dead, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Hmm. And a whole lot of one of the guys that I worked with there in Saigon, one day he didn't show up to work. As I said, they kind of worked their own hours there. It's not no real big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Second day, he didn't show up to work. Guys got worn about a little bit. Third day, he didn't show up to work. So they sent a bunch up downtown where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
He lived downtown. And they found him down there at his girlfriend's house. He was soused.
Mm-hmm.
He was dead drunk,
mm-hmm.
if you want to call it that. So they got him and they took him into the hospital. And the hospital medevaced him out to Walter Reed. And when I mean dead drunk, he was closer to being dead than you might think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Walter Reed kind of dried him out. And they shipped him down to Fort Hood. He was down there when I got to Fort Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was, the sergeant first class. And his profile said he was not to be assigned to any job that required to make his decision.
Really? As a senior NCO?
Uh-huh. His brain was pickled.
Really? Wow.
He couldn't make a decision.
Hmm.
You could set him at a desk with a telephone in front of him and tell him to answer the phone. He can answer the phone.
Hmm.
Maybe he could call to somebody in the room that the phone call was for.
Really?
And maybe he couldn't.
Wow.
But he could take, put him at a table with a deck of cards and play pinochle. And he'd whip you all over the place.
Really?
But he knew that very well before anything happened to it.
Hmm.
But he didn't have to make a decision playing pinochle.
Hmm. Wow. I actually just saw a movie about a situation like that the other day.
This guy was there.
Hmm.
I knew him very well.
Hmm.
And also the guy that volunteered me to go to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
I wound up working with him at Fort Hood when I got back.
Hmm. So actually, let me switch CDs here. This one's, this will end CD1, the interview with Mr. Franklin Jones. Okay.
One that I've didn't tell you about on the team. I don't think I did.
Mm-hmm.
It was about the mountain yards.
Oh, no.
We had a bunch of the mountain yards that was relocated down into the lower areas. And one is, the mountain yards was kind of a different people.
Mm.
They're to Vietnam what the American Indian is to America.
Right.
One of the mountain yards that they brought down there, they had forced issued us a bunch of supplies. One of the things that they gave us on the team was a bunch of combat boots. One pair of the combat boots is size 15. I thought, ain't nobody in the team could wear a size 15. So I said something about them. Next day, one of the guys brought in one of these mountain yards, and the boots fitting, size 15.
Big feet.
Big feet. He wasn't terrible big. He was taller than most of the Vietnamese. But the mountain yards within the south part of the Vietnam were smaller stature, closer to the Vietnamese. I'm told that the mountain yards in North Vietnam, 6 feet and above, average height.
Wow.
They are very tall. Mountain yards are very much inbred. They have little family groups. And that's kind of the way that their life is revolved around as a family group. Until the Americans was involved over there, they had a statistic that they run whenever the Americans was early 60s. It's not accurate, but it's close enough to get a good idea. The mountain yards had never been more than 20 miles from the place that they were born all their life.
Wow.
It's not accurate, but it's close enough to get a real good idea how close that they are.
Wow. Yeah.
When they would move, the whole family would pick up and move. They'd move around on the mountains, in the mountain areas, and do a lot of slash and burn, raise crops. The mountain yards had been the dwellers down by the ocean, and they've been fishermen and all until the Vietnamese came in. The Vietnamese, they take their name from the region of Viet in China. And Nam means south. So people in the southern region of China that moved south down the coast are Vietnamese. That's how the name come about.
Okay. Makes sense.
That's one meaning of Nam. Means southern Viet.
Okay.
As the warlords. The warlords of Viet got kicked out of China. The Vietnamese language is a simple enough language. If you know 500 words of Vietnamese, it's equal to about 2,500 in English. And then you turn around and throw all the articles out. They have very few articles. And you can get away with all these and all the articles. You got a pretty good vocabulary, 500 words. I came back from over there with the speaking and reading of about a fourth grade level.
Well,
I couldn't write it. By the way that we went through school, you had to learn to read it to be able to speak it. And we had Vietnamese instructors. Now, I don't speak it very good. Whenever I was in the hospital a year ago, there was a Vietnamese doctor that was in the hospital. He was doing electrosonogram on my heart. And I started talking to him in Vietnamese. He was very impressed that there was a round-eyed guy in Lubbock that could speak anything. And we was having a pretty good conversation there for a little bit, and then he got real quiet. And I thought, uh-oh, something bad wrong. And it was.
What happened?
I had a heart attack. I was having one when he was listening to my heart.
That's not good.
I just had one artery stopped up completely.
Wow.
They run, they call it Widowmaker.
God. Glad to see things have worked out a bit better then.
Yeah. Everybody said, how you doing? I said, well, I got up this morning, put both feet on the floor, stood up, took right there. Do real good.
Yeah. Fantastic. So, Just, I guess, a couple more questions. How soon after the ceasefire did you leave the country?
9 days.
9 days.
Well, the reason it took so long is I had some paperwork I had to get straight down to Saigon. Mm-hmm. And our personnel sergeant, he told me one day, he said, Jones, you better get the next flight out of Saigon that you can get on, or you're going to be here for a while.
Well,
he said, I've already got it verbal that you're supposed to stay.
Hmm.
He said, but I won't keep you until I get it in writing. He said, but once I get it in writing, you've got to stay.
Wow.
Everybody that could speak the language was supposed to stay behind. Mm-hmm. You're on the four power teams.
Wow.
So you had the four power team, and then you had the recovery team.
Mm-hmm.
You had two different teams there.
Right.
The recovery team was going around looking for remains, and they had to have people that could speak a little bit of Vietnamese around those teams.
Mm-hmm.
And then the four power teams, of course, you had the VC, NVA, the Arabs, and the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
They flew around the country quite a bit together, too.
Hmm. That's been interesting.
That's how come it took me so long to leave over there. Although I left the team the day of the ceasefire.
Hmm.
And I had to get some of the paperwork straightened out of Saigon. And of course, I had to study for the P-test.
Right.
You had to take a test before you could leave.
Yes. Now, coming home, first of all, how long did it take you? And second of all, what was it like coming back to the States at that point?
I don't remember just how long it took. You know, we flew from Saigon to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Landed in Hawaii for long enough to refuel an aircraft. We got out, looked around the airport. Never got out of the duty free part.
Hmm.
And flew on into California. And kind of everywhere after that.
Hmm.
You know, it was about, it seemed like it took over 12 hours to fly.
Hmm.
But I don't remember just how long. Whenever we went over there, we went from California to Alaska to Japan to Clark. Air Force Base in the Philippines and then into Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
But coming back, even when I came on R&R, we came from Saigon to Hawaii to California.
Mm-hmm.
And that is no shorter than going around Alaska down.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Like if you think from here to from here to Vietnam, you think they go west to go to Vietnam or southwest.
Right.
Okay? But now, what would it be if you think going north? It's shorter.
Yeah.
It's shorter.
Yeah.
But the way we look at a map, you always look at it laid out.
Right.
You don't, if you take a globe, you can picture it out better.
That's true. Hmm. Yeah, I've done the leg from Hawaii to we did it from Hawaii to Chicago, and that was murderous.
Yeah, that's if your legs cramp, you know, you really cramp up. Yeah, of course, whenever I went to Vietnam, it was a different bunch of guys on that plane.
Right,
they're all crazy. Somebody on the plane had a recorder, tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
Mockingbirds on it, a German commode flushing, and a whole bunch of sounds like that. You go over there, and all of a sudden it starts rattling down through the cockpit of the plane.
That's bizarre.
You land there in Clark, go in the snack bar, the airport, start hearing the mockingbirds sing. I guess Clark now is the amusement park.
Mm. Yeah, so I've heard.
Just covers the volcanic ash and the amusement park.
Yeah. Philippines, some of the Philippines at least doesn't seem to be too happy with U.S. troops there again currently.
While I was in Vietnam, they did capture a Japanese at Clark.
Yeah, actually, I've I haven't read his book yet, but he actually wrote a book called My 30-Year War, or something like that. So now, arriving back in, in California first and then coming home, it was the end of the war, but I mean, did you see any anti-war demonstrations, feel any anti-war sentiment or anti-military sentiment?
After we got back?
Yeah.
There was still some. Mm-hmm. Hey, there's still some today,
mm-hmm.
but not that much.
Really?
Not like there was before.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of people that would do anything they could to keep going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
One of my best friends, he was, wasn't really a draft dodger.
Mm-hmm.
He went to a canyon, he went to West Texas State, and he took ROTC when he was up there.
Mm-hmm.
And he got commissioned in ROTC. Well, at 60, there was nothing going in Vietnam to get shook up about.
Right.
I think it was 62, wasn't it, the first American got killed over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, when he graduated from Canyon, there wasn't a whole lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew there's enough that he didn't want to go in the military and risk going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So he came down here at Tech. He got his master's degree. And it's going a whole lot better over there.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't going to go to Vietnam. And then he got to thinking, what do you do with a doctorate degree in English besides teach? And he didn't want to be a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So he switched over to psychology. And he got his doctorate degree in psychology. And the Army hadn't said nothing to him. But when he got his doctorate degree, man, he was rolling real good in Vietnam.
Mm.
That was around 68.
Right.
So he goes to the state capitol and down to Austin and does intern work in the state hospital. He's a psychologist with an internship in the state hospital. Well, when he got his year intern work in, then the Army calls him.
Mm.
He said, would you like to come in as a first lieutenant or a captain? First Lieutenant MI or Captain Medical Corps.
Hmm.
He said, well, what's the commitments? He said, well, MI is 2 years, Medical Corps 4 years. He said, how about if I go in MI for 2 years and if I like it, then switch over to Medical Corps and stay?
Hmm.
He said, okay. So he was in the Army, went to Fort Knox, did his officer's basic, and then they shipped him to the Pentagon.
Hmm.
They didn't even ship him to do his branch training.
Hmm.
He worked in the Pentagon with a full colonel up there in the Army Psychology Department.
Wow.
That's the only two of them that was in there, in the whole department.
Hmm.
And then he got 6 months early out of the Army. And the only reason he wound up with a doctor is because he didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Huh.
Now, he didn't dodge a draft.
No.
He completely did the legal way around and everything else. And he didn't even have to go to England to go to college.
Hmm. Hmm. Absolutely. Hmm.
And he could say he went to England went to college.
Yep.
But he didn't have to.
No. Definitely not.
And he did his commitment to the military. And everybody was happy.
Mm-hmm.
And really, him being in the military for this what, year and a half, was probably the best thing that could happen to him. Because when he got out, then he got a job with a company that he decided was a field that he really liked.
Mm.
And he went, set up his own company in Dallas as a business consultant agency. He said he didn't want to work with sick people no more.
Mm.
And he didn't want to be a teacher. Well, last year he sold the company. Under the condition he hadn't worked for him for 2 years after he sold it. And I'm pretty sure that last year that he finished up his house, it was going to run about $2.5 million and it'd be paid for.
Wow.
Down in North Dallas.
Wow.
Because he didn't want to go to Vietnam. And he didn't want to be no dirt farmer out in West Texas.
Uh-huh. Oh, fantastic.
His little brother did go to Vietnam, though. Mm-hmm. His little brother, he's playing with a band. He's very good with the, and he was doing real good with the band. And he got orders to go to Vietnam. He came back home, just outside of Lubbock here. Mm-hmm. He was over here in Lubbock one night, going to the movie, and said to the movie, the Lindsay Theater. And all of a sudden, all kind of trash started coming in the vents and everything like that. And everybody, somebody whined in the back door and said, hit the floor, there's a tornado. He said he got down between the seats. And the only thing he could think of, boy, I hope I get to go to Vietnam. He did. That's when he heard the tornado came through. Hmm. You probably heard about the tornado that took half of it.
No, I haven't.
You hadn't heard of the 70 tornado?
No.
Wiped out a whole bunch of town.
Really?
Oof. Started by Jones Stadium. Went downtown and hooked out toward the airport.
Huh. Wow.
And Ranch and Heritage Center, you know the burns around
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah.
That's the trash.
Really?
Bricks and trash and everything from the tornado. They had to do something with it.
Mm.
They made the burns up there with it.
Huh.
He did his tour in Vietnam, came back. His little band was waiting on him. They had a booking at the Golden Nugget, and they couldn't make it till they got their lead guitar player back.
So he still live in Lubbock?
Well, he lives up between Broadway and Silverton now.
Hmm.
We went back with that band, and they really did pretty good.
Okay.
Then he went down to Dallas and set up his own recording studio. And mm-hmm. from there, he went to Nashville and played as a pickup player, guitar player.
Wow.
Very good.
Excellent.
And he retired. He'll go live with his dad
mm-hmm.
out on the farm.
Excellent.
They live over there in the wintertime. They live in the Mendoza in the summer.
Hmm. Okay. Anything else?
Anything else
about your experience you'd like to talk about?
Don't know a whole lot more.
Okay.
That's one of them years that things come back to you a little bit at a time,
mm-hmm.
and something might pop up any time, and it might not.
Okay.
But I've told you, I think kind of how my tour was different than the other people, by the way, that I thought when I went there. And the thought that I had while I was there. I didn't go that thing just by war from somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't my thoughts. Because you can't fight somebody else's battle.
Mm-hmm.
They got to fight their own battles. Now, you might can help them or something like that, but you can't do it for them.
Okay.
While I was there, we had no ground troops. The only ground troop we had was FCAP.
Mm-hmm.
It was at Tonsonoda, it was at Long Beach.
Okay.
Garden Airport.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And while I was there, there at the heliport at Long Beach, he got hit one night. The sappers got in and blowed up some of the JP-4 tanks.
Oof.
About two or three days later, one of the chopper crew just came in off the mission. He's walking back up on the hill, going home for the night. Went to one of these old vacant buildings that was down in the lowlands.
Mm-hmm.
There was a racket going on. He thought there was a pot party going on over there, which was very common.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs were very free. He went and told the MPs that he thought there was a pot party going on down there. So the MPs, like a good bunch of police, they hopped in the jeeps, and they'd go blaring down the hill, circle the building, go up, kick in the door, down the whole sacred platoon, living on Long Beach. The Long Beach was one place, and then right next door to it was Plantation.
Mm-hmm.
The plantation was really our headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Plantation, Long Bend and Plantation both had been a rubber plantation.
Mm-hmm.
When I was there, there was maybe four or five trees that was growing in a little gully between the two. It had all been defoliated.
Mm-hmm.
Probably with the nice little thing they call Agent Orange. Now, was I exposed to Agent Orange? Who knows?
Mm.
I drank the water.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they're saying nowadays if you were in Vietnam at any point, you were probably exposed to it.
Depending on where you're at, your chances were better than other places.
Yeah.
Like, they're on the team. There's a lot of woodcutters that was around there. And the triple canopy jungle that you heard, they're normally teak or mahogany.
Mm.
And they go in there and they cut a teak or mahogany log, which is about as long as across this room.
Mm.
And it's as big around as this room is tall. And you put it on a 5-ton truck, it's just all that truck can do, get up a hill.
Because
that sucker is so heavy. And there in the province, there's come up with a bright idea one time that they're going to wreck those logs, float them into Saigon with a barge, which is a good idea. Well, they rolled them off into the ocean. And they sunk.
Really?
The teak and the mahogany was too dense to float. You think wood floats, but if it's too heavy, it won't. And the little crates that they put some of my stuff in, I shipped back. It was made out of mahogany plywood. It's the cheapest material they have over there.
Right.
The little Catholic priest that was there in the province, he made some furniture out of some of that wood. Boy, it was beautiful.
As we're going on, other questions are popping up. You mentioned drug use.
What?
Drug use.
Yeah.
Was there a lot of it over there with U.S. servicemen that you were aware of?
Yes and no.
Okay.
There was, but then, on the other hand, a lot of it stopped on one try. If a kid had been, say, doing a little bit of heroin or something, and say from New York or California, he goes to Vietnam, he could go down on any corner and buy it, go out, pop the same amount that he did at home, he did.
Right.
Because he'd get 99% pure stuff in Saigon.
Hmm.
And what he'd get at home, maybe it stepped on about 8 or 10 times.
Hmm.
I mean, all he's getting is just a little bit.
Mm.
And he gets over there and he hits the same amount of stuff and he done overdeed.
Mm.
And, you know, that's for the big drugs, they didn't do that much.
Right.
Because they. Now, one of the guys on the team, I'm pretty sure that he was on some of his own morphine, but he knew what he had.
Right.
And he was pretty well tripped on lots of times.
Really?
Hmm. And there was one night, whenever I had the duty for the night, we always had one American wake all night long. Teams to check the guards and things like that. I went out to walk around the compound checking the guards. I found this little guard with his bluey pipe. Well, he was zonked.
Right.
About 2 o'clock in the morning. And I went and opened the gate, kicked him off the compound. Went and walked up the commander of the guard, the head Vietnamese, and told him he was going to walk the guard for the rest of the night. And see, that's open season. Anybody on the streets after 10 o'clock at night, there was curfew at 10. And at 2 o'clock in the morning when I kicked him off the compound. So.
Right.
So he really had to pick his way back home. Being tripped out at the same time.
Right.
But the senior province advisor, he called me in the next day and said, man, we can't just fire one of them. We got community relations we got to keep up. We got to have to put him back on. I said, well, you're the boss. I took him, took the guard. We went down to the compound. I took him back to one of the back bunkers. That night, I took him back to the back bunker, and I said, now, any time that you're on guard, this is your bunker. And I said, you see that snake crawling in the wire? Yeah, I said, it was a bamboo banana viper. It was just almost 6 feet long. Very big. He would crawl around and crawl up there and catch the bugs. It was in front of the spotlight. I said, now that's my snake. I said, you kill that snake, I'll kill you. But anytime you're on guard, this is your bunker. Well, after that, anytime he was on guard duty, he might not knew what was going on 10 feet away from that bunker, but he knew where that snake was at the whole time. Now, we had guards posted in bunkers, two back bunkers, was away from the road. The two bunkers over next to the road, one of them was close to province headquarters, we didn't have anybody in. And the other one was manned. But I told you about the water tower, the water in the bottom, the water in the top. Well, up around the top of the tower, that's where they kept a bunch of the rounds for the M79 up there. And there was a Claymore clacker up there also. That Claymore clacker was into that corner bunker. And the bunkers were made out of artillery canisters. Metal canisters that laid on top of each other.
Right.
And about 6 feet of dirt between it and the outside. And all the inside of those canisters was laced with explosives and shrapnel, rocks, nails, anything else the CBs could throw in there.
Right.
And they went back up to that water tower. So they figured if anybody got into that compound, that was the bunker they was going to get into. And that's where we kept our small arms ammunition and all extra was in there. But we figured if anybody got in there, that's the bunker they was going to get into.
Wow.
So it took somebody to get a hold of that placard, pop it, and that bunker would implode. Well, that bunker would implode, and there was a pallet of Bangor torpedoes that the CBs had left there too.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know just where they were buried. But you know what a Bangor torpedo is?
Yeah.
The 4x4 pallet, 6 foot long. Jeez, pieces, yeah. Buried in the yard. And they may have been next to that bunker or under it, even.
Yeah, I don't want to find that by accident.
The CBs, they know what to do with them. Before they left, all the stuff that they couldn't get rid of or didn't have time to get rid of, and they wouldn't want to just leave it behind or whatever, they took a little boat, went out in the ocean, kicked it over the side.
Yeah.
I know they did that with a bunch of torch outfits and welders.
Yeah. By the end, they were doing it with Hueys, too.
Yeah. They had, they left a steam shovel type deal there in the front yard. Finally, somebody from Saigon come in, picked it up, took it out. Every trip in Saigon, I made two trips a week in that 6 months in Saigon. In front of me or behind me on the road every day, somebody got blown away.
Really?
But I had a gimmick, and I think I'm going to say it worked. I said before, they wasn't trying to kill Americans. So I wanted to make sure that they knew I was American. So this deuce and a half I drove, the gas station here, they was giving away little Texas flags, so the stick-on deals. And I had one there stuck on the east side of the hood, that Deuce and a half. Although I had Vietnamese bumper markings on the thing.
Yeah.
On the side of, they knew what Texas flag was. I mean, they may have been dumb Vietnamese, but they knew what a Texas flag was. Yeah. I've had to, me and this medic, we'd take off early in the morning, sometime 5, 6 in the morning, then hit the road going to Saigon. That way we could get back up that night. And there's a couple of times that we went to Saigon, and either the checkpoint going out of town or else the road clear crew got hit behind us. Mm. We'd already gone down the road before they got blowed off the road.
Wow.
Even Claymore's were. We probably went by it before the BC went out and set it up.
Wow. It's got to be a little unnerving.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it makes you want to get out early.
Yeah.
No, Deuce and a half, there for a long time. Every time I went in Saigon and back out, I had to take it over to maintenance and had to put some new injector lines on it. And vibrated them off.
Really?
The only way that thing run for me was get in it, put it on the floor. Couldn't honk the horn.
Right.
Go through the towns and try hitting the horn, it would work. The air governor wasn't working. The only thing that would govern the air pressure was when it hit the pop off. You know, it wouldn't regulate the air, it would just, when the tanks would pop off. And it's too much air pressure for the horn to work.
Well,
stop good, don't have good air pressure. We're flying through them towns though. See, I want that to slow down. This old medic, he usually had a 45 underneath his jacket. I carried my M16 and I had my grease gun stuck on the seat.
Really?
Well, that was another thing I had that nobody was signed for. Right. 35 caliber grease gun with 220 round clips taped together on. That always stayed on the seat. But if I was driving, I would take time to reach up for a rifle.
Right. Nice and compact.
Being the men of, I think it is that made him. Not when he, me and another guy went into Saigon one day. We went into headquarters there, MACB headquarters. Well, of course, we had our rifles with us. Pistol belts on. Walked in the snack bar. MP's in it. He said, "You can't come to the snack bar with a rifle." I said, "Well, where are we supposed to live?" He said, "Well, you know, I had the clips in." He said, "You got that rifle loaded?" "Yeah." And I didn't carry around a rifle, it's not loaded. He said, "Well, you got to carry your weapons to come to the snack bar." I take mine down, this other guy takes his down, pull the clip out, stick the clip in our belt, reach back, pull the bolt out. Shell goes flying across. "What? One in the chamber too?" "Oh, yeah. Ain't no use carrying one unless you're ready to shoot it." I don't care if it's the headquarters. The guys there, they didn't even know what was happening 10 miles down the road. Like I said, people got blowed off the road. There's one day we went back out the team. We were driving down the highway, little old A-10, flying over the road, flies down in the woods, and you hear rat-a-tat-tat, and the boom, boom, boom. Come back over, fly back over the road, down back in, make another strafing run. You see it? One day we went down the road, and they was sitting in the road with a deuce and a half, with twin 50s in the back of it. Shells all over the road. Man, they've been ripping up the wood line. They got some kind of fire out of the woods. So they were returning fire. But a beehive round is one that's really good with the artillery. Now that's the one that used them mostly. And it's strictly a defensive weapon. That's as all a beehive round is. And I think a 105 howitzer has 40,000 nails in a beehive round.
Wow.
you know what a two-penny finishing nail is?
Mm-hmm.
Take, mash the back end of that nail into a pin. And that's what you've got in a beehive round.
Flechettes.
And I'm told, I've never seen one fired, but I'm told that literally you can nail a guy to a tree. Yeah, I did do some direct fire with a Fort Seal. I was training on the howitzers.
Mm-hmm.
But ours, we was firing at a 6x6 target.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a big thing to hit the target.
Right.
It's good for me if you can knock the tip of the course down and sober it up.
That's cool.
It's like whenever we go to the range in Germany, all the ranges in Germany was KD ranges, full targets.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't nothing to be shoot the bullseye on a target, you know. Too many of us old farm boys,
mm-hmm.
Rays were shooting rifles. But the thing was, when they would put the spotter up there to show you where you hit, shoot the spotter.
Uh-huh.
But the ideal thing was to hit the wooden stick that was in the middle of the spotter.
So they couldn't put it back up?
No, it rattles.
Uh-huh.
You hold that stick, and he hits the stick, and boy, it just vibrates the next time. He hits the metal, you know, you hear the ding, but if he goes through the stick,
yeah,
he's gonna vibrate your hand. The last time I went to the range, I was SFC then, started first class.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everybody had to pull targets. You know, you shoot half shoot, and the other half's in the pits.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go pull targets. I was going down to the pit, and this guy comes down to the pit. He said, "Who was shooting on number so and so?" I said, "Oh, I was." He said, "Every one of the shots you put in that target, I'd cover with my palm and my hands."
Wow. What range were you shooting at?
It was 7,500, 150, 200, and 300.
Mm. Wow.
That day we went all the way back to 300.
Wow.
Now, I grew up shooting prairie dogs.
Mm.
They just stick their head out of the hole.
Sure. Now, after returning home, how long did you stay in the Army after?
After coming back from Germany?
From Vietnam,
I was stationed at Fort Hood for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then back to Germany for another 3 years.
Right.
Okay. All together, I spent a little over 8 years in Germany.
Hmm.
And then I moved to Lubbock from Frankfurt, Germany.
Hmm.
Back here at Lubbock, finished up my leave that I was on, and I had to go to Fort Sill on the 31st of December, sign out up there,
mm-hmm.
and come back.
And that was 81?
December 31st, 81.
Wow. Fantastic. I guess so.
I've been retired 20 years and 1 month now, right?
Mm-hmm.
7 days, 8 days?
So, yeah. Days. Terrific. Well, let me go ahead and formally end this. This formally ends the interview with Mr. Franklin Jones.